Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, July 17th, 2010. Tech News Today is brought to you by viewers like Broken LCD, who calls me Stubble McBeardy. You can be like him in the chat room live every day and call me whatever you want at 5:30 p.m. Eastern at live.twit.tv. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Becky Worley.
Behind the board is our formidable producer, Eric Lanigan.
Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Or in French, formidable. Also joining us today is my old friend, Brian Cooley, host of All Things Car Tech and the original Top 5, not that Revision 3 knockoff. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, drinking, buddy.
How's it going, buddy?
Good. I'm trying to you know, do Top 5 in an honorable way there, Doctor.
And you're doing a fantastic job.
Well, thank you. That's just trying to honor your legacy.
I'm happy to have you here on Apple Day.
When I know, good day to come on the show for the first time.
Jason Chen is getting his stuff back. First of all, before we even get into the press conference this morning, San Mateo County is going to withdraw the warrant and give him his computers back. What's up with that?
Yes, really a big development in this story, Tom. So it started with the EFF posting this news that the warrant had been withdrawn. I called Jason Chen to find out if this was good news. Congratulations. And Jason said, yeah, good news, I think. And good news for everybody. Free bumpers for your iPhone 4, ever the geek. But he's redirected me to their lawyer because, of course, in an ongoing case, he can't speak to the press. I did speak with the DA from San Mateo County, and he explained it this way. Jason Chen and his lawyers have agreed with the San Mateo DA to withdraw the warrant, meaning Jason's going to voluntarily submit his computer and all of his gadgets to be forensically examined for evidence. Now, what happens here is Jason goes on record as volunteering the information. That's perceived of as a good thing in his defense. But it also takes the First Amendment issues and the Shield Law and all of the journalism questions off the table. And that means that the trial will proceed at a much more speedy pace. So I've reached out to Jason's lawyer to try and get some tactical information about why this is beneficial to Jason, aside from just the volunteering. But it really begs more questions than it answers.
It does, and it leaves this case off. I should rephrase this. Back up. It keeps this case from setting a precedent on Shield Law. It totally takes it out of that loop.
Yeah. That's right. This isn't bloggers now saying, well, you know, bloggers get the same rights as journalists. I mean, is that how you see it, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this is one of those things that we've yet to really sort out still because of this, right? I mean, we're not going to be creating precedent that we'd like to see done. This would delay that, right?
I think it just takes it off the table. It just becomes a very straightforward case of, was this theft? And my gut instinct is that there's some deal that's not being discussed that says, hey, we just want to get the information so that we have proof that we know who sold it to you. We're just going to go after that guy, and we're going to leave Jason alone. That's my speculation
leave
on
Jason
all of this.
Leave Jason alone! This could have been a landmark case, though. This could have gone all the way to the Supreme Court. It could have been a big deal, but this guts that possibility.
Yeah.
I mean, has any other case come as close or had any significant effect to figure out if a blogger has the full weight and measure of a, quote, journalist? This kind of had the makings of that if they'd taken the other path, right?
They have extended Shield Laws to include bloggers in previous cases, but it hasn't hit this situation before, this sort of like protecting sources as much. If I remember right, there were some questions around the woman who was outed as a spy and giving up sources and all of that.
Valerie Flint.
Yeah, I'm a little vague on that. But they did extend it to include bloggers at that point. But this would have been an important case in extending that law for sure.
Such a strong search.
There was also another case involving Shield Law with Apple a few years back. So, I mean, I think it would have been a more clear definition. And this one was because there's the assertion of an actual crime being committed with theft on the part of the person who took Gray Powell's phone. I think that it becomes so much more muddled and complicated that I'm sure that if Jason Chen got some sort of a deal where it's, hey, you get a pass, we just want that guy. And I could see this being like, speedy result, get me out of here.
On to the Apple press conference, the upshot of which this morning at 10 a.m. during the press conference, Steve Jobs announced that he is deeply sorry to the customers, not the investors, but to the customers of Apple, and is offering them a free bumper. I guess sometime next week you'll be able to go online, say, yes, I have an iPhone 4. I'd like a free case. You'll have a few to choose from, whether it's a bumper or a case, because they don't have enough bumpers for everyone. They over and over and over tried to state how small the problem was, how overhyped the problem was, and how much they love their customers, and also mentioned that there's going to be an iPhone 4 proximity sensor fix in the works, as well as alluding to the fact that they're not done with the antenna. They may provide some more fixes sometime before September 30th.
Yeah.
September 30th is the end date for the free case.
And even that, I think they almost, I think at the end and during the question, they said that the September 30th is a revisit date. That may not be the end of this program, but it does sound like that might be a target date to have some new engineering done, which, of course, begs the question, will that do exactly what Jobs said that they don't like to do, which is to foreshadow the next product? Because he was asked at the end of the press conference, why were so few cases out? And he says, well, we didn't really share these new iPhone 4s with a lot of second-tier case vendors, because you know what happens, it leaks. Word gets out, people stop buying the 3GS. But by the very nature of this press conference today, it sounds like there's an iPhone 4.1 coming, and that might also dampen sales.
You know, the headline on this is Jobs apologizes, bumpers and cases will be available for all who bought the iPhone 4, or refunds for those who have already purchased their cases or bumpers. But you don't get the full sense of how Steve Jobs felt about this unless you see what his demeanor was as he delivered the big news. Check this out when he says he's going to offer bumpers.
A lot of people have told us the bumper solves the signal strength problem. Consumer Reports is the latest one this week. We've heard it from a lot of people. Why don't you just give everybody a case? Okay, great. Let's give everybody a case. We've got our bumper case here, but we want to give everybody a free case. Every iPhone user is going to get a free case. One for every iPhone 4. If you've already bought one, we'll give you a full refund for a bumper. And we're going to do this for every iPhone 4 purchased through September 30th. We'll re-examine this in September and decide whether to keep going, or maybe we'll have a better idea.
Can you hear the frustration?
Okay, great. Let's give everybody a free bumper.
He could not have been, you know, sucking on a lemon any harder. It's like, all right, fine. You want a case? Here's your damn case. Get away from me.
He also, at one point in the Q&A, someone said to him, you know, first question out of the gates in the Q&A, how's your health, Steve? And he says, it's great. And then he, at some point later on, says, I'd be even greater if I could have stayed on my vacation in Hawaii instead of coming back to deal
with this. That's
so.
Right. I forgot about that one. Yeah, now this was, I picked up an extreme frustration and exasperation and, you know, this sort of idea that, oh, you're all so silly. First of all, you, the media, who've whipped up too many of my customers into a froth that I think is completely nonsense or close to nonsense. Here, take a case, get away from me.
Yeah, and I think that as you do the redux on this, the bottom line is, there is an antenna issue. All smartphones have reception issues. This one has been made into a big deal about the iPhone 4. It's because the press loved this story. And he threw out some facts to support his assertion. He said the return rate for the iPhone 4 is 1.7%. That's less than the 3GS. He said, which was, I think, 6% on the 3GS. 6%. He also said users who called in to AppleCare about antenna reception problems account for 0.55% of total calls to AppleCare during the time it's been out. And then this was the most interesting stat. He said the iPhone 4 does drop more calls than the 3GS, but only one more call per 100, or 1% more than the 3GS. You buying that, Tom?
Yeah, I would buy that because it's like 99% uptime. 99% uptime sounds great if you don't know any better. It's horrible. 99.9% is okay. 99.99, now you're getting there. If you get five nines, you got great uptime. So these stats are misleading. One out of 100 more could be quite a bunch. And I think that is also watered down by the idea that these are just the folks who have complained about it. There's plenty of people who've complained to each other, who've complained on blogs, but haven't actually called customer support.
They tried to call from their iPhone 4 and couldn't make the call.
Right, or just stopped making calls because they can't. You know, they get frustrated. Yeah. And that may pull down the average of dropped calls. But, I do think overall that this is blown out of proportion. I think that a lot of people who have iPhones don't have a problem with it because either they don't rely on it for making calls or just the way they use it doesn't affect it. But for those who do use the iPhone in their left hand, they want to make a lot of calls, it's a huge problem. So you have a small percentage that are very, very upset. And, you know, attitude and arrogance aside, this is the right thing for them to do, especially considering that they're still looking at another fix down the line that maybe puts a coating on this or does some sort of exchange program. The straw that broke Steve's back on this was Consumer Reports. And Becky, you tried to get a hold of them to find out what they thought of this, right?
Yeah, their vice president of editorial was in the audience and asked a question. And I was able to speak to Paul Reynolds, who's their electrical editorial VP back in New York. And he said they stand by their assessment. They basically issued a statement saying that consumers deserve answers and fairness. Providing free bumpers is a good first step towards identifying and finding a solution for the signal loss problem. But he said they're not changing their review. They're not going to be able to recommend the phone just because of what Steve Jobs said. So they stand by it.
And people that have this problem are very angry. Whoopi Goldberg is a good example of someone who's very angry.
Okay, what happened here? I missed this on television. What on earth did she do?
Take a look. You'll get to see it.
I took that bad boy. I opened the car door. I said, damn!
You know they're about to offer a fix for that, right?
There's no fix for this. My phone was bad. It wasn't just that the antenna was bad. It was bad.
I think what's interesting here is she had a bunch of dropped calls, and her perception of the problem, probably because of all the stories, was so huge that she just gave up and took her iPhone 4, threw it right down on the ground, and she said she murdered it.
I don't think that's a reasonable response to the problem.
If you're wealthy and looking for good material on television, I think it's a great response.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I will not be taking my 3GS and throwing it on the ground the next time I drop a call. And I don't think you should do that with your iPhone 4, Tom.
The next time I drop a call, I'm grabbing Leo's iPhone and throwing it out the window.
Slamming it in the car door, right.
Yeah, not doing it with mine. That's expensive.
Right. All right. Next time I drop a call, I'm going to call that person back.
That's pretty much what I do. Or text them.
Uh-huh.
Call you when I get home. Finally, Apple has posted up the video from the press conference if you want to take a look at it. And they also put up a smartphone antenna performance page where they carry on the task of trying to convince everyone that this is not just an Apple problem. This happens on a lot of different phones. So they've got BlackBerry up there. They got an HTC up there trying to demonstrate the problem with other phones. Even so, it is definitely still a bigger problem on the iPhone 4 than it is with other phones. Let's move on to non-Apple news. Firefox Home for iPhone has unveiled in the App Store. Crap, it's still an Apple story, but it's about Firefox. Firefox Home is just shy of Firefox being a browser on the iPhone. And what it does is it uses Firefox Sync, which used to be called Weave, to give you all your bookmarks, all your history, and all your open tabs on your phone. So
let me see if I understand this right. You're cruising Firefox on your computer, and you're logged in. And then you got to go do something. You grab your phone, and you open this Firefox app on your iPhone, and it simulates the exact set of tabs that you have open on your computer in real time.
Yeah, well, it just lists them. It's they're not actually in tabs or anything. They're just listed on the device here. I'll open mine up right now, and you can see all the tabs on my phone. Are actually you can't really see it on this shot, but they're there. It's a little
white. It's a list.
Yeah, it's a list. I've got, you know, my Gmail inbox, Twitter, Google Docs, Tech News Today lineup, Facebook. It's all the stuff that's open right here on this machine is on the phone as well. So if I leave this on at home and I realize, oh, there was a story open in a tab that I want to read, I can find it on here, click through, and read it in Safari. That's the key. It doesn't have a browser. It just uses Safari to pull up the pages. But you don't have to leave the app to do it. You can read them in the app.
I don't know. That sounds kind of cool. I think I'd be all over that.
Rupert Murdoch's paywall has been a big experiment, and the Times of London and the Sunday Times as well. They said, we're not going to let people have a free ride. We're going to put them behind the paywall. We're going to de-index ourselves from search engines, and we're going to show how you make money off of news in this new web society. No more of this freebie-jeebie giving away content. Well, according to a story on Slashdot, this is turning out to be a miserable failure. Slashdot pointing through to a story from newser.com, where they have a source who says, not only is nobody subscribing to the website, but subscribers to the paper themselves are abandoning it when they show up to the registration page. If you subscribe to the paper, you get the website for free. You don't have to pay extra. But once they get to the registration page, they go, nah, I don't want to have to go through all this. And so they just go back and read the newspaper.
This is comforting for me because I haven't heard a good, solid bit of Tom Merritt bile about all pay models that Rupert Murdoch embraces rant in a while. So this is good.
Well,
not saying he's on anything brilliant here, but it's good to see you get one of these stories. You can, you know, Rupert Murdoch, I'm going to make you pay for stuff again.
Well, my position on this the whole time has been, you can do this if you want. You have control. You can stop the search engines from indexing. You can put a paywall up. But the way he's been talking about doing it sounds like it will just take your newspaper out of circulation. It's like saying, no, you can't, you know, let's make it really hard for you to read our newspaper when it's really easy to read everybody else's. And so, of course, a lot of people are just like, forget it. I'm going to go read everybody else's. In fact, this Newser story has a really interesting quote from a PR person who says, why would I get any of my clients to talk to the Times or the Sunday Times if they're behind a paywall? Who can see it? I can't even share a link, and they aren't on search. It's as though their writers don't exist anymore. So it's not just about the consumers anymore.
He thinks there's more than one Wall Street Journal in the world, which, to be honest, there may not be. I mean, that is one of the few papers that has a singular role that can really, few papers of any decent circulation that can really command a paywall, and they don't even lock it down that tightly.
No, you can still link to a Wall Street Journal article. It can get frustrating sometimes if you try to click it more than a couple times because they track that, and then they don't give you the full story anymore. But at least you can pass around that link, whereas the Times is just it's like it doesn't exist.
Can you guys weigh in on this? Why is it that the Wall Street Journal can get away with that type of a paywall, and when the New York Times tries it, it's a miserable failure, or people are so doomsday about it? What's your take on the difference in the papers and why the paywall is different for both?
Why the Journal is such a must-have tool in a professional sense. The New York Times is a must-read for a lot of people, and also in their role of a person in business, but not to the degree the Journal is. The Journal is a tool, and I think it's also easy to justify corporately, to justify as an expense item. It's easy to get a lot of companies to pay for your subscription, but it's also justifiable to yourself as a tool and not just an elective, which I think the New York Times, as solid as it is, people see it that way.
Yeah, I think the Wall Street Journal almost acts as a trade publication. And when you think about that in the print world, you can charge a lot more for a trade publication than you can for, say, Good Housekeeping, because it's a specialized audience and it's the kind of information you're only going to get from that trade pub. And so you're willing to kind of write it down as a business expense if you're in that industry. And I think a lot of people see the Wall Street Journal the same way.
Okay, I buy that.
Will you buy the Wall Street Journal?
Not, what is it, $14.99 a month on my iPad? What, are you nuts?
Yeah, are they kidding? Ugh.
So it can't overcome all inhibitions.
Yeah, but I'm not a trader. I mean, that's your point is well taken. I'm not a trader, you know. If I was working on Wall Street, what choice would I have?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal and I write it off here at work. I could never do that with the New York Times. I'd have to just eat it myself. I can tell you that right off the bat. And I could easily make a case for it, but I know it wouldn't fly. So there's that. I'm telling you, when you can expense something like that, you get tons of subscribers that you otherwise will never see come in the door. It's like the convention and trade business the same way.
Well, they must be tough at CNET because, you know, when we were back at Peck TV, we could expense almost anything. You remember Joe K, Tom? He expensed pantyhose and razors at CES 1 year.
He did.
We never really understood what that was all about.
Well, you know, I have no idea. I have no response to that.
You're going to answer, but then everybody's going to know about your fetishy side business. Huh?
I didn't expense those. It was
you had a justification. So now we all know something about Dudley Do-Right.
I was thinking maybe it was a booth babe situation, but the only booth babes we ever had at CES were when I worked at CNET. We had the woman in the box demonstrating digital living. So wrong company.
It's so weird.
On to a automotive story, which we had to have at least one when we got Brian Cooley, Mr. Car Tech, on the show.
I checked out by now. Yeah, come on. So, Toyota and Tesla did a little deal about a month and a half ago where Tesla is going to use the abandoned Toyota GM plant here in the Bay Area to expand and build their next Tesla car, the Model S. And as part of that deal, Toyota invested $50 million into Tesla. Here's the first fruit of that. They are going to be delivering an electric version of the RAV4, but really it's a rebirth because if you think back, that was one of the very first electric cars from a major maker. The GM EV1 being take that out of the portrayal. So this is going to be a RAV4 coming back with a pure electric powertrain again. Well, this time all engineered by Tesla, and I can expect that this is going to be something that is going to have a reasonable price tag. It's not anywhere slated for sale just yet, but this goes to show you what Toyota got invested in Tesla for, is they believe that their technology gives them a faster route to a pure EV lineup again, as opposed to rolling their own.
I think the RAV4 is a really interesting choice because these cars were last produced in 2003 and they're still selling on eBay Motors for like $40,000. They're still popular with that hardcore EV crowd.
Was the 1997 RAV4 all electric? I didn't realize they were selling an all electric that far back.
Apparently so. I remember it from the early 2000s, but if they were going back that far, that's pretty impressive.
So this is a big boost for Tesla, obviously, because they need this kind of juice to expand their lines, expand the appeal, make a little extra money off of the higher end than they make off the higher end Teslas, which sell for a lot of money, but they're not selling a ton of those things. And no. They get to take over the NUMMI plant in California, which it was a big local story here when it closed, but it's also a huge win for Tesla in that they have their own really big, really well-outfitted plant, I would assume.
Yeah, well, and a major partner is a key thing. It's the stamp of approval, and you have Toyota investing in you. But I still have a creeping suspicion, and I can't back this up with anything, but that Toyota doesn't invest in anybody. They don't invest in anybody that they're ever going to be afraid of. So to me, this is lining themselves up to make sure that they're in line to acquire Tesla first and at best terms, and this initial RAV4 project may be a testing project to say, okay, what's this company all about? Let's put them under a stress test and then consider acquiring them as a unit of our firm. Now, I don't know if that's why Tesla got into this. I suspect not. It's a very strong, independent young company. But I got to believe that Toyota's thinking, okay, do we buy these guys or not? What's the best way to find out? This.
Yeah, that's
they
a good
did
point.
It because they need the cash, Brian. I mean, they're so maxed out trying to produce the Model S. That I think that Elon Musk just said, we got to get in bed with somebody big if we're going to do this. I think it also aided their IPO. And so they debuted at $17 a share. They've been trading down since then. So I think that they need a positive boost. And Tom, the answer to your question, I think, about the RAV4 being a pure EV play versus a gas play, they made an EV model and a gas model, but I don't think they ever did sort of the combined thing like the Volt will be.
Okay, gotcha.
No, it was EV only or gas. And the EVs were very rare. Let's not, you know, make this sound like it was a big production model. It was a boutique version of the RAV4 when it was made.
On to a story sent to us by Hate Bad Design, who's a regular in the chat room, said researchers have password cracked OAuth and OpenID. Now, if you don't know what these are, OpenID allows you to log into multiple websites with just one ID. And OAuth is used to authenticate your ID from somewhere else. So, for instance, if you use a Twitter app, say, on your Droid, and you log in with your Twitter ID, OAuth is what is used to authenticate that Twitter ID so that the app can log in to your Twitter account. These guys have done what's called a timing attack, which up until now had been thought to be virtually impossible to do over the internet. But researchers Nate Lawson and Taylor Nelson say they've discovered how to figure it out. The way a timing attack works, it measures how long it takes for the machine to reject a password and then guesses how many letters it got right, because it looks at the password one character at a time. When you have direct access to a machine, that can work pretty well. But over the internet, there's so much lag and interference and changeable times. Nobody thought that this was able to be done. But these guys say they've figured it out, and they're going to be demonstrating it. To say, like, we have figured out how to account for all the internet lag and all the uncertainty, and we can do a timing attack against OAuth and OpenID.
What's your perception of the benefit of actually demonstrating an exploit like this? I mean, if it's something that's corporate and can be fixed and needs to be fixed on a larger level, then, of course, you know, share the exploit with the company and somewhere down the road make it public. But do you think that there will be a big change in protocols because of this recognition that the timing hack actually works on these authentication protocols?
Yes, absolutely. This is how the security industry works, is you have these conferences. Folks show the stuff off, and then everybody immediately starts to figure out how they would defend their network against it, how they could do it better. That's how security research works best, is when you put the stuff out there and say, hey, I've shown how I could do this now. Let's get to work on figuring out how to stop it. Otherwise, only the bad guys know how to do this.
I get that. But I'm just wondering if something like this that, I don't know, it's always that catch-22. Like, can you just tell a couple people?
Right.
I understand from the big picture, but one of these, you just kind of hope that maybe a couple really smart guys can figure it out first before you make it public.
And a lot of times in these demonstrations, they will stop short of revealing some essential information because of that fact, because they're like, this is actually kind of hard to figure out. So we're not going to show you this yet. We may show it in individual cases, but we'll kind of keep a little bit of this under wraps. But, this is an ongoing debate in the security community, and generally more openness ends up being better for security than less, even if it makes you feel uncomfortable on the outside. It's better for you in the long run, in most cases.
iPad 18857 has a very simple solution for this in the chat room. He just says, randomize the time to return the validation.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Maybe it's as simple as that. I don't know. Maybe that's what everyone will come away with. It's like, oh, well, now that they figured this out, I'm going to go randomize the time of my return. Because probably nobody was worrying about it because everyone thought it was impossible to do over the internet. So they figured, we're over the internet. No big deal.
Well, if you can ping the exact transfer times for data, then it makes sense that you would be able to figure out the timing on the backside. So that's just a thought.
And finally, a British-made solar-powered aircraft has been airborne above the U.S. military testing range in Arizona for 7 days. The Yuma Proving Grounds. People who follow military history probably recognize that as a place where a lot of history has been made. And the Zephyr, made by the Ministry of Defense scientist firm Kinetic, has been up in the air for 7 days. They're going to try to go for 14 days. They've already set a record and hope when it lands that the battery still has a bunch of juice in it, because this thing doesn't have a pilot in it. It doesn't have any payload. And so if they want to make it useful to put somebody in or to fly things in it, they're going to have a little more juice in it than it has now. This is different than the flight we talked about previously on Tech News Today, where they actually had a pilot flying overnight. This thing's been flying overnight and overnight and overnight, but without anything in it.
Nobody in it, no food, no NASA diapers. It can go a lot farther.
It would seem like you'd need so little extra capacity, though, with the miniaturization and the lightweight of today's components that you'd need for visual acquisition and then transmission to a ground station, that they could almost trivially add that. I know I'm oversimplifying, but this is really exciting because this, it sounds like they've got it. It's not like they have to add 200 pounds to this thing to give it a visual device for remote observation. It would be a much lighter component than that, and I would think they could put that on there at a very near design stage.
And with all of this different research going on, I figure within 20 years, we'll have pretty much nonstop flights. And I don't mean nonstop from one airport to the next, but like flights that never have to refuel.
And this gets into an interesting area. You know, here I go on the car tech again. But, you know, we need one of the things that we need to really go to the next step of live navigation with photorealism, which is, you know, easy to do on the smartphone if you've got the data feed coming in, is to have lots of overhead cameras, which are very difficult to do unless you had a variety of hover-able devices like this. So planes that are not, you know, fixed wing, but more of a hover device, how they would design that, I don't know. But if they've got this worked out already, they can get very close now to saying this is going to be a mesh of hovering, unmanned video acquisition devices that just cover a metro area. And wherever you are, you can just see what's happening live in a given traffic or other situation. It's one of the breakthroughs that a lot of the GPS people talk about right now.
Yeah, wait till Google gets a hold of that with their AirView planes. How much trouble are they going to get into?
Well, that's right. Yeah, but there'd be nothing to capture. It would just be live. It's no more a matter of acquiring and posting. It's a matter of our eyes are in the sky all the time. Creepy.
Yeah, goodbye privacy. All right, let's go and try this out again. We debuted this for the first time on yesterday's show. It's a lightning round of stories that we really don't have time to go into depth and kick around and discuss, but we're just going to give you the headlines. And today we're going to try to make it even shorter and even faster. So
I contributed something unique this week. I have a two-word reaction to each one.
Oh, I can't wait. This makes it exciting.
Excellent.
On your mark,
that up. I hope I can pull it off.
You can do it, Brian. Go.
Yeah.
Google is halting the Nexus One sales through official stores after the current inventory is depleted. It'll only be available through KT in Korea and Vodafone in Europe after that.
About damn time. And damn time is one word.
Motorola responds to the Droid X bootloader controversy and says that eFuse isn't there to break the phone or blow a fuse or anything like that. It's there to prevent malware from running on the phone. So you're fine.
I don't get it. One word.
Google acquires MetaWeb. Now, this is a service that tries to answer complicated natural language questions in search. They are trying to create a smarter, more connected internet, and now Google wants to do that too.
And
even creepy.
Two words. And finally, Microsoft has beaten the Wii in console sales last month. The Nintendo DS led all consoles in sales. PS3 is in fourth place, but behind the Xbox 360 and the Wii. The Wii was the first one to go down in numbers. They are the first time that they have gone down in numbers. And Red Dead Redemption, the Xbox version, followed by the PS3 version, led game sales.
Hate gaming.
And that's
my two words would be connect effect.
Yeah. Maybe. Oh yeah, absolutely. And or slim effect. Connect slim? Splenect?
There you go, splenectomy.
All right, let's move on to the calendar.
Just a couple of little things. Number one, I want to just talk about the iPhone 4. One of the big pieces of news that came at the end of the press conference, it's coming to 16 other countries on July 30th. We're talking about Canada, a bunch of European countries, Australia, New Zealand, and Hong Kong. Next, a change in Twitter. When you search for someone in Twitter, if you use the search box, you will get not only tweets with people's names in them and such, but there's a little set of icons that come up that represent actual people. So if you search for me, you'll find my Bea Wirley account and also account, apparently, that's my legs are tweeting, just as Tom's beard is apparently tweeting. Good to know that Twitter has made this all the more possible for those of you who are searching for my legs and Tom's beards.
What comes up when you search Brian Cooley?
Mm-hmm.
You get Wicked Be Cool Brian Cooley. Yeah, there's several Brian Cooleys on Twitter besides the original Brian Cooley.
Original as registered by Dr. Tom Merritt.
That's right. Thank you.
Why is he a doctor to you?
It's a long story, but After enough drinks, you'll see that part of him emerge.
Wow, okay.
You'll need a doctor. On to the voicemails, our first caller.
Let's not put it that way. He's a doctor, but not to me. I won't let him touch me.
Okay.
Our first caller has a philosophical question, even more philosophical than that one.
Hey, a philosophical question for you. Have you spent a lot of time trying to figure out the difference between a nerd, a dork, and a geek? Does that make you a nerd or a dork?
Yes. The answer to that is yes. We spent way too much on that.
I think it's the omission. I think it's actually geek, because geek is the fixating on one single thing, right?
Yes.
Yes, the obsession probably makes you more on the geek side. That's true. And therefore, on this particular topic, you have now proven yourself geekier than I.
Good parse. Nice.
Our next caller takes us to task. We had a lot of fun with the antenna engineer Ruben Caballero's name from Apple yesterday, because Becky suggested his name meant sandwich cowboy.
And I was just worried that we were being had, and the name sounded a little made up.
Well, our caller says it doesn't quite mean that.
Hello, this is GAC in West Virginia, and I have one little correction. Becky was calling the guy Ruben Caballero sandwich cowboy. Caballero does not mean cowboy. It means something like gentleman or a knight. So I think you should just call him Sir Sandwich. Thank you.
Sir Sandwich, and I would like to apologize. I now know Vaquero is cowboy and that Caballero is gentleman, as this gentleman said. But there is also a reference to knighted gentleman or gentleman riding on a horse. So I kind of squeaked in there, but yeah, my Spanish stinks. Sorry, guys.
So our apologies to Ruben Vaquero for confusing him with Ruben Caballero.
So wrong.
260-TNT-SHOW is the phone number if you would like to correct us on our Spanish. You can also email us, tnt@twit.tv. Becky, you want to lead us off with the first email?
Yeah, this is from S. That's all we get there. He said, just saw episode 36-32 when you introduced the lightning round. He says he likes the idea, but it was kind of unbalanced. Tom was speaking rather fast, and I was going at my regular pokey speed. So maybe, S suggests, to get into the lightning round, you could make a graphic that includes a timer. Eric could start you off, and you run down the news stories as fast as you can so that that buzzer doesn't hit in the middle of your story. It would create a sense of urgency to the lightning round.
Ooh, now it's a little game.
I like
it. How many stories can we get in before the buzzer clicks off?
Oh, like that approach, yeah.
Musical chairs. The one who's reading when the buzzer goes has to buy beers.
Find out why Tom's a doctor. That's perfect.
Exactly. So many things happened with this. He's suggesting 2 minutes. What do you think? Is that too short?
I think a minute.
Oh, you think a minute?
Let's try it.
Well, let's try it. I feel like we won't get too many stories in, but maybe we will. Maybe we'll get fast with them. All right, on to Josh, who wrote in and said, on the RIAA amnesty thing you talked about, back in 2003, the RIAA set up a program called Clean Slate. They dropped it in 2004 after very few people signed up. I know I wouldn't sign up. Not that I'd have any reason to do that, of course. Love the show, Josh. And yeah, there's an old Ars Technica story that says the RIA tried to set up a clean slate thing where you would sign in and you know, swear that you have deleted all of your pirated music and you'll never pirate again, and you'd sign a statement. It wasn't even as harsh as the one that was suggested yesterday, and nobody did it.
So many things tech, though, sometimes I think these ideas come about before their time, before the mainstream consumer understands or is ready for the issue. So I don't know. I still think that it would be a good thing to have, to at least say they have it available for people, and that if you want to go to confession, great. And if you don't, you can just burn in hell.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, if you look at the amnesty along these lines, that there's an IRS amnesty going on, and those tax attorneys have to go spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on the radio advertising that you can take advantage of it for a limited amount of time. People don't even do that, and that's an amnesty of much greater monetary value for many people. And also, it's not an amnesty, but look at the honor system reporting your internet purchases to pay your use tax. Now, again, you got to pay money if you do that. But a lot of folks who supposedly want to do the right thing don't take advantage of that because nobody takes advantage of that.
I think that's mixing apples and oranges because I think internet tax is confusing. It's not well publicized and it's very unclear where the law stands. So I think that the IRS amnesty is actually a good analogy because it shows that the IRS is trying to make amends. And at least for the RIAA, this would be an effort to reach out to consumers and at least put it to rest for some. So I understand your point, but I totally disagree. What are you, nuts?
Okay. No. I understand that you're nuts, but I totally disagree.
One isn't. All right.
All righty, damas y caballeros. Gracias for watching. Tech News Today, or listening, depending on how you consumed it. Brian Cooley, a pleasure to have you on. Tell the fine folks all the wonderful stuff you're doing over there at CNET.
Oh, it's simple. Just come on and check us out. I do a lot of the car tech stuff here, if you don't already know that. So go over to cars.cnet.com for all of our car tech stuff. Or if you want to get right to my podcast, Car Tech Live with Wayne Cunningham and Antoine Goodman over here on CNET, that is cartech.cnet.com.
And don't forget to watch CNET Top 5 with Cooley, because that show was invented by a genius.
Yeah, but I inherited that. I just keep the engine running, keep pouring gas in the tank. It's great, you know.
Runs like a dream. And you can give us a call here at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can email us tnt@twit.tv or find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. Thank you, Commander Cooley, for being on the show. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Adios.